Hello. A major Andrew Wyeth retrospective opened this week at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. It's one of three current local Wyeth exhibitions. We'll take a look at the painter who, despite being ignored by the art world for much of his seven-decade career, has remained true to his own artistic vision. Albert Stumm looks into how artists and arts organizations are helping local economic revitalization. Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at A Skull in Connemara by Martin McDonagh. It's at the Iron Age Theatre in Norristown. And in our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com, we speak with Pennsylvania Ballet Artistic Director Roy Kaiser about his long association with the company. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Andrew Wyeth has made an indelible mark on American art. The first fine artist to receive both the Presidential Medal of Freedom and the Congressional Gold Medal, his work spans over 70 years and multiple media. This latest exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art joins the Brandywine River Museum in Chads Ford exhibiting 40 paintings from the artist's own collection, and the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington showing 32 early Wyeths from its permanent collection. The title of the Philadelphia Museum of Art show is Andrew Wyeth, Memory and Magic. Earlier this week, Museum Director Anne Darnancourt explained why.
Memory and magic really have to do with the fact that Wyeth, like all artists, but in him particularly intensely, he's using the store of memories and experiences and feelings he revisits them or they are called up suddenly very sharply when he looks at something. I think it's you have the sense as you walk through the exhibition that objects that are depicted by him, whether it's a kettle or a rock or a small mussel by the side of the sea, a seashell, or the seashell in the wonderful painting Her Room, that seeing these objects which he knows well, all of a sudden release. It's like touching a spring, a hidden spring in something that suddenly releases a jack-in-the-box of a feeling. And then the whole painting or the whole is about getting that feeling into the painting somewhere. That's why it's memory and magic. And the memory is the fact that these things, these spaces, these rooms, these hills, whatever they are, evoke some very strong memory or feeling. And then the magic is in fact that I think a lot of Wyeth's work has, if you will, a surreal quality, which a kind of he's not a camera recording, and not that it's fair about cameras, because of course cameras in the hands of different photographers plumb all kinds of depths. But it's not photorealism, and it's not mechanical. Whatever it is, it's not mechanical. He has extraordinary skill in teasing these memories and this sense of magic out of paint and out of watercolor and out of paper and onto the surface of his canvas or his pad of paper. But that's not the magic one refers to. The magic is somehow the connection. It's the sort of subterranean connection between the artist and what the painting is really about and the viewer who senses what the painting is about. And the interesting thing is, of course, every viewer brings their own experience. So we're not talking about, my standing in front of Groundhog Day and having the same experience that Andrew Wyeth has. Of course not. I mean, it's more what does it evoke in me? What trains of thought or trains of emotion or references does it set off in my mind?
Philadelphia Museum of Art Director Anne Darnancourt. Andrew Wyeth's most iconic painting may well be Christina's World, an image of a young girl sitting stretched in a meadow gazing up a hillside at distant buildings. Reproductions of Christina's World, postcards and posters, are among the best-selling items at the Museum of Modern Art's souvenir shop. The work is notably absent from the exhibition in Philadelphia, as it's too fragile to travel. There are, however, several other instantly recognizable Wyeth paintings on view. Although beautifully crafted and executed, Wyeth's paintings can be understood on many different levels. WRTI's Susan Lewis explores.
Many people appreciate Wyeth as a great realistic painter, but his unadorned images belie different layers of meaning, says Kathleen Foster, curator of American art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. She points to the boots in the title picture of the exhibition as a good example.
It's called Trodden Weed, and it shows Wyeth himself in boots, but you only see the lower half of his body, so you don't even recognize that it's a portrait. And that picture is full of personal stories for him. He had almost died in surgery when it was painted, and so it was a meditation about death. The boot is stepping on a weed, and he began to think about how death was so random and ever-present in the landscape, and the painting is about that. But also the boots are boots that belong to his father and to his father's teacher, and they're pirate boots. So he's becoming a pirate in this picture, and he's becoming his father and his father's teacher, and he's becoming a figure of death. So all those different allegories are present in the painting.
And while the name Andrew Wyeth brings to mind certain consistent imagery, this show demonstrates the diversity and range of his work, says Foster.
You can see the changes in color, the changes in paint handling, the changes in the ideas, but then certain consistent principles of imagination almost that have endured. So in some ways, he's been very steady, very consistent. In other ways, his style has changed dramatically.
However his style changed, Wyeth did not follow fashion, at least as defined by art circles in the 1960s. His persistent pursuit of his own vision in his own style placed him outside the mainstream. When critics turned their attentions to the great wave in abstract expressionism practiced by artists such as Willem de Kooning, Jackson Pollock, and Franz Klein, Anne Knutson, a guest curator from the High Museum in Atlanta where this exhibit first showed, says Andrew, or Andy, Wyeth was ignored and at times even vilified in professional circles.
In graduate school, we were all taught to just ignore his work because he wasn't painting in that abstract style when that was in vogue and popular.
Despite the fact that Wyeth followed his own path, Philadelphia Museum of Art curator Kathleen Foster emphasizes that he was not painting in a vacuum.
He was definitely absorbing ideas from all over the map. I mean, from the Renaissance and Albrecht Dürer right up to Edward Hopper and the regionalist painters of the 1930s. I'm quite sure that he was looking at the surrealists. We can see this from the work of the late 30s and the 40s. We have some of this work in the exhibition, and I think it will be some of the most surprising paintings to people.
Throughout his career, Wyeth's work has remained popular with the public, and today he has reemerged as an important living icon in the history of American art.
He was assigned to the margins by the critics. He, however, remained deeply popular, widely popular, to a large public. And so, in fact, that marginality, I think, was created by a margin of critics. However, given what was seen as the mainstream in New York City of abstraction, yes, he was seen as working on the sidelines. I think it's now, in the early 21st century, a moment where we can understand that many strains of art can be working simultaneously, that there isn't a single mainstream, and that someone like Wyeth, who sort of stayed true to his own personal credo, can have a vitality, a legitimacy, an integrity that is tremendously appealing now.
Andrew Wyeth, Master Drawings from the Artist's Collection, is at the Brandywine River Museum. Something Waits Beneath It, early work by Andrew Wyeth, 1939 to 1969, is at the Delaware Art Museum. Andrew Wyeth, Memory and Magic, is at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. All exhibitions run through July 16th.
Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis. As one luxury condo project after another fills the Philadelphia skyline, a less publicized development trend is emerging. It's long been known that artists are urban pioneers, drawn to rundown neighborhoods by their low rents and gritty character. Now, though, it's more than just individual artists. As Creatively Speaking's Albert Stumm explains, both for-profit and non-profit organizations are starting to embrace artists as a way to spur economic development in blighted areas.
The Kensington neighborhood of Philadelphia was once referred to as the workshop of the world. Everything from plumbing supplies and car parts to bottles and fabric was produced there. But by the 1950s, the economic manufacturing model shifted away from urban vertical factories to more efficient sprawling suburban ones. The change took the jobs and people away from neighborhoods like Kensington, leaving countless behemoths to rot amid a decaying landscape. But now, artists are being tapped to help revive blighted neighborhoods. One such example in Kensington is the Coral Street Artist's House. A former textiles factory, Coral Street is surrounded by boarded-up buildings and used car lots with barbed wire fences. But rising from these ruins, the Gleaming Rehab contains 27 units of low-income live-workspace primarily for artists. The NKCDC, the New Kensington Community Development Corporation, used low-income tax credits and other funding to complete the project. The NKCDC's Director of Economic Development, Sarah Thompson, says the organization's primary focus is to promote the neighborhood's overall business climate, but she recognized the potential benefit of working with artists.
We've been working on with artists for probably the last 3 or 4 years. There was a trend of artists moving into the neighborhood, but because there's such a big population in our neighborhood and growing, I realized they are mini businesses in a way, even if they're the only person working for themselves.
The NKCDC also acts as a liaison between artists and socially conscious developers. As well as encouraging galleries and cafes to open along Frankfurt Avenue, the group is hoping to build a black box theater on vacant land it owns, complete with performance space and offices for nonprofit arts groups.
We're looking to do it on one of our most blighted blocks on Frankfurt Avenue, so we hope it'll kind of instigate some of the people who are sitting on their property to actually do something to their property. A lot of the speculators or investors, they have a lot of money they can just throw down, and then they sit on it and wait, and then it only stymies development, which is really frustrating.
Speculators aren't the only problem. The secret is out about the neighborhood. Property values in some cases have quadrupled in the last 5 or so years, and some shells of buildings list for 6 figures. That almost makes development by smaller nonprofits prohibitive and forces artists to again move to cheaper neighborhoods on the fringes of Philadelphia's ever-expanding center. This was the trend in Old City and later in Northern Liberties. The current development wave is unique, though, in that the artists and developers enjoy a symbiotic relationship. While developers exploit the artistic population, whether for profit or economic revitalization, the artists themselves have access to affordable housing and workspace. Still, in the end, the very artists who helped improve those neighborhoods get priced out. And that's what happened to Nicholas Cripple, an artist, a professor at Temple's Tyler School of Art, and a partner in the newly converted Crane Arts Building, also in Kensington.
Well, I lost my studio to a developer, so here I am developing studios. This was the third time I've gotten pushed out of a building, so I was actually looking for a much smaller space where I could maybe just have 2,500 square foot of studio and rent the rest of it out just to pay the mortgage, and instead came up with this very large space.
The Crane is a 4-story, 95,000 square foot building, formerly a plumbing supply manufacturer and then a frozen foods warehouse. It now houses exhibition and meeting space on the first floor, and on the top 3 floors, 39 artist studios priced below market rental rates. The project is intended to make money, but Cripple's partner in the venture, Dave Gleason, says he is aware of the potential pitfalls of redeveloping in a blighted area.
We'll probably bring some new people into this neighborhood, and it seems to be attracting other developers. It's also real important, though, to make sure that economic development is done as equitably as possible with respect to people who have really been trying to make things work for themselves here for decades and decades, and that's always the tough balance.
In West Philadelphia, the People's Emergency Center Community Development Corporation, or PECCDC, is also looking into completing live workspace. The PECCDC also has helped support a Second Fridays night modeled after Old City's First Fridays, where galleries and businesses stay open late to bring more people to the area. According to Trish Downey of the PECCDC, artists in this case were more the driving force to revitalization along Lancaster Avenue rather than a resource to exploit.
It's not necessarily that we're trying to redesign the area or anything like that. We have a very, I want to say, organic philosophy towards community development, holistic philosophy, where we draw on what is already in the neighborhood and what we already have and what people are already looking for. We've done neighborhood plans with people in the community, and through that process, that's how we found that there were already artists living in the area.
And it's not just local groups getting into the mix. ArtSpace, a nonprofit developer based in Minnesota, partnered with the William Penn Foundation to locate at least 3 multi-use properties around the city. ArtSpace has completed projects in dozens of cities, and it came up with a business plan that allows each building's equity and rent from its commercial tenants to subsidize rent for its artist residents. Each development will contain some combination of artist live-work, retail, office, and performance space, but the nascent project has yet to name possible locations, partially to discourage real estate speculation in the proposed areas. Artists have always been considered risk-takers, willing to sacrifice the finer things in life for a cheap space with high ceilings, reinforced floors, and cut-rate prices. And all this development geared toward the so-called creative class may be a great thing for Philadelphia neighborhoods. But the reason for artists' existence is often overshadowed in the discussion. For the most part, artists don't want to be urban pioneers. They only want a place to create. Yet, as they search for affordable studios and abandoned warehouses, they may very well be their own worst enemies.
Creatively Speaking's Albert Stumm.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
In the past decade, Martin McDonagh has created a lot of buzz in London and New York theatre circles. In 1997, the Anglo-Irish writer had four plays professionally produced on London stages in one season. William Shakespeare is thought to be the last playwright to have achieved such a feat. Following the Broadway success of McDonagh's Tony-nominated Pillow Man, his 2001 play, The Lieutenant of Inishmore, is now a big hit at New York's Atlantic Theatre Company. Yet while McDonagh's plays have gained considerable attention, you might not find a lot of opportunities to see his work. As the Iron Age Theatre in Norristown prepares to open the Philadelphia area premiere of A Skull in Connemara, they found that producing a McDonagh play is an especially ambitious undertaking. Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer has more on the local theatre's experience with this playwright's work.
As part of a trilogy of plays set in the west of Ireland, A Skull in Connemara centers around gravedigger Mick Dowd. When the local graveyard becomes full, it's Mick's responsibility to make room for the newly deceased and dispose of the old tenants of the cemetery plots. As the story begins, it's time for Mick to exhume the remains of his own wife, who suffered a violent death 7 years earlier. Town suspicion surrounds Mick and his role in his spouse's death. Another question on the mind of many townspeople revolves around what Mick does with the corpses he digs up. Here, Mick, played by Bob Wyke, provides one explanation of his procedure to Mary Johnny, played by Susan Giddings, and Marching, played by Adam Altman.
Where did you put all Mary's relations, Mick, then now? The old bones and whatnot.
You won't let on.
Oh, will I not let on?
Let on so.
I let on so.
Oh, now you're chipping in.
I am chipping in. What did you do with them?
Oh, what did I do with them, is it?
It is! For the 100th time,
is it? Oh, for the 100th time, is it? I'll tell you what I did with them. I hit them with a hammer till they were dust. And I pegged them by the bucket load into the slurry.
You hit them with a hammer and you pegged them in the slurry?
Can I do that now, Mick? No, you can't do that.
Mick's claim of taking the bones of corpses and crushing them to dust only scratches the surface of the morbid and violent nature of A Skull in Connemara. Because his subject matter is almost always dark, McDonagh's plays are considered dark comedies. Actor Bob Wyke notes that many people connect with this type of humor.
It's unusual to see these things happen live on stage, and for an audience live to witness that. It's shocking on the one hand. It's wild and dark and hilarious, and you almost feel guilty laughing, but you can't help but laugh because it's just absurdly, grotesquely funny.
Another common thread of A Skull in Connemara and the rest of Martin McDonagh's plays is Ireland. Although raised in London, McDonagh has deep Irish roots. His parents are from Ireland, and as a child, the playwright-to-be annually spent his summers in the rural and rugged west of the island. Iron Age co-artistic director John Doyle.
In each of his plays, he sort of takes a shot at Ireland in some different way. And it's strange because he finds many problems in Ireland. And certainly the relationship of the IRA and England is certainly an issue. But even just the difficulty of the rural life in Ireland, he seems to talk about. Both the boredom of that life and the fact that that boredom may in fact inspire a certain antagonism between people because they have nothing else better to do than to fight.
The often disturbing and dark tone of a McDonagh play is reason enough for some theaters to avoid tackling his work. The edgy plays are not very appealing to theaters seeking family-friendly fare, for instance. The logistical demands of McDonagh's scripts are another reason some theaters steer clear of his work.
I'm not saying that, you know, we're special because we're taking this on, because other people do produce his plays.
Iron Age co-artistic director Randy Wise.
But it is a very big challenge for a theater to do a Martin McDonagh play because he doesn't make it easy.
For example, says Wise, the Skull in Connemara story calls for a graveyard in the set design. Mick Dowd actually does his grave digging on stage. This means the Iron Age Theater had to transport over 20 cubic feet of topsoil and 300 square feet of turf onto the stage to create a cemetery within their intimate fourth floor theater hall.
In a space this small, the reality of it is very important because you're so close to the scenic elements that, you know, real grass makes a difference at this range. And those are real tombstones, too, up there. Most of them came from Laurel Hill Cemetery. They donated some tombstones to us. So,
did they go back?
Yeah, oh, yes. Oh, yeah. They wanted their tombstones back. I don't really have any use for them once the show's over. So, yeah, they'll go back down there.
After writing A Skull in Connemara and six other plays within a decade, Martin McDonagh recently claimed he has no intention of going back to writing plays, at least not anytime soon. Instead, his sights are set on filmmaking. His 27-minute movie, Six Shooter, which he wrote and directed, just won an Oscar for Best Live-Action Short Film. Next year, he's slated to direct his first full-length feature. Just as he's been an up-and-coming playwright to watch over the past few years, he might very well be a filmmaker to keep an eye on. If A Skull in Connemara and his other plays are any indication, McDonough film audiences should expect humorous, dark, and ambitious storytelling.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer. The R&H Theater opens A Skull in Connemara at the Center Theater at 208 DeKalb Street in Norristown this Friday. It runs through May 7th. Now, in our regular dip into the Culture File section of GoPhila.com, we take a look at Pennsylvania Ballet. Pennsylvania Ballet was founded in 1963 by Barbara Weisberger, a protege of legendary Russian choreographer and former New York City ballet master George Balanchine. The inception of the ballet was part of a nationwide movement to start professional ballet companies in towns that weren't New York City. When founder Weisberger hired a young dancer named Roy Kaiser in 1979 for the Corps de Ballet, she may have hoped he would later become a soloist and then a principal dancer, the ideal progression. But that Kaiser has continued on with the company after his retirement from the stage in 1992 and has worked his way up to his current position as artistic director would probably have greatly pleased the company's founder. Now Roy Kaiser shares some of the history of the company he knows so well and his own changing role through the larger part of that history.
We're in our 42nd season, so we've been around for a while. That's actually, for an American ballet company, a long history. I think there was a small company in Philadelphia at the time that was using Philadelphia Ballet, or the Philadelphia Civic Ballet, maybe. So it couldn't be the Philadelphia Ballet. It was the Pennsylvania Ballet right from the beginning. There was a movement in the early 60s to have the art form spread out across the country and really move outside of New York. There were a lot of cities that were not really served by resident ballet companies. The Ford Foundation had some grant money that they were awarding, and George Balanchine, the brilliant choreographer and ballet master of the New York City Ballet at the time, was also involved in this process. And that's how Barbara Weisberger ended up being the woman to found Pennsylvania Ballet, because she was a student of Mr. Balanchine's as a child. In the early years of the company, Mr. Balanchine was listed as an artistic advisor at one point. He was very involved in the founding of the company. He gave Barbara, in those early years, his ballets. He would say, here you go, they're good for the dancers to dance, the public will like them. The backbone of the company is the Balanchine repertoire. Many people claim that that he was a genius. I don't know exactly how you define genius, but he certainly was prolific, and he really changed the face of classical ballet. He really emphasized speed and attack and brought an excitement to the art form that I think for a long time had been a very staid art form, very set in its tradition. He made it okay for ballet, for instance, not to tell a story. You know, he made it okay for audiences to come to the theater and to be able to experience classical ballet, but without all of the sets and the costumes and all the peripheral things that were so important to ballet, really just come to see the movement as a reflection of the music. There's really not a classical ballet company in the United States today that would exist without the Nutcracker. It's our bread and butter, and thank goodness. And Mr. Balanchine, again, with New York City Ballet back in the 1950s, really started this phenomenon when he created his Nutcracker and performed it at the City Center in New York around the holidays. It immediately became not just about the ballet, but it became about this great holiday tradition. But most importantly, and we tend to lose this sometimes or forget this, it's really a good ballet. It wouldn't still be around today if it was just about the tradition. It's around today because it's really a good ballet with some wonderful choreography. The score is one of Tchaikovsky's best. It's just brilliant. I've been here forever. I'm in my 27th year with this company. I came here as a young dancer. I came here because I saw this company perform on tour. The first time I saw Pennsylvania Ballet perform was in Seattle, Washington. They were on tour there. I was a young dancer, just starting to figure out what I was doing or what I wanted to do. Saw the company, auditioned for the company. They accepted me. I moved to Philadelphia. Said, "We'll give this a shot. You know, we'll give it a year, and we'll see what happens." And 27 years later, I'm still here. I had a career that I just thoroughly enjoy as a performer. I mean, it's just, it was such a special, invigorating way to live your life and make a living. You know, at first I was like, wow, they pay me for this. This is incredible. I just always found new challenges. Towards the end of my performing career, I started to take on some other responsibilities. I was very interested in a lot of the administrative aspects of the company. I was very interested in teaching the company and rehearsing the company. And very early on in my performing career, I started to really realize that I really wanted to direct. And the longer I performed, the stronger that sense became to me. I really felt like that's what I was meant to do. The stars were aligned and certain elements fell into place to make it possible for me to lead this company. It's very close to me, and I'm very passionate about it, so that makes all of the difficult aspects of the job much easier.
Pennsylvania Ballet Artistic Director Roy Kaiser. More information on Pennsylvania Ballet can be found at the Culture File section of gophila.com. And that's it for this week. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Frank Luzzi, Emily Sharamy, and especially Paula Butler. Paula, Washington, D.C.'s gain is very definitely Philadelphia's loss. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.